Not a good night for Democrats in the governor's races, at least. They seem to be taking a cue from Eminem. All right, now lose it.
Just lose it. It wasn't always easy. I know you all know that.
Just because we didn't get the right result tonight doesn't mean we get to go home and whine.
That's Corzine and Deeds conceding their races. But if all politics are local, do these defeats in New Jersey and Virginia mean anything nationally? And is this a hint of things to come for Democrats in midterm elections? Just lose it. Losing it in Virginia and Jersey, but winning in New York, we're getting mixed messages on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 4th. I'm Celeste Headlee here with John Hockenberry. Good morning.
I wish I could do that Eminem thing. Loser. I love that. Good morning, Celeste. Also on the program, we have a snapshot of racial politics in Atlanta's mayoral race. It's kind of a seniors pitching duel in Game 6 of the World Series. Hints of a brave new world in the U.S. auto industry and gay parenting. We talked to a 15-year-old raised by two fathers.
But first, Robert McCartney joins us. He's a columnist for The Washington Post. Robert, we have supposedly mixed messages across the map. Are these wins for Democrats and Republicans in these races, or is this a win for moderates across the board?
Well, I think it was mostly major wins for two Republicans in big states who ran as moderates.
So, both?
You can say both, but look, the Republicans won, took back from the Democrats two big populous states, New Jersey and Virginia, and I think that's much more important than this Democrat winning in one upstate congressional district.
Okay, Robert McCartney, stay with us. We'll be back to you in just a few minutes. But first, everything you need to know this morning.
He's counting the electoral votes in New Jersey and Virginia, that's for sure. As we've been saying, lots of election news out now. The key results, the GOP celebrating two major victories in those governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. Purple and blue went red. Both governor seats went to Republicans. In New York's 23rd district, it was a Democrat who won a longtime GOP seat in a special congressional election. And staying in New York was an unexpected nail-biter in the mayor's race. In the end, Mayor Michael Bloomberg did narrowly win a third term.
In other city votes, Atlanta and Houston's mayoral races are both headed for runoffs. In the Atlanta race, the city could put its first white mayor in office in more than 30 years. In Maine, people have voted to ban same-sex marriages. Earlier this year, the state legislature passed a law that would have allowed gay marriage, but opponents pushed for a referendum to appeal that law. And police in Ohio have now recovered 10 bodies at the home of a convicted rapist. The Cleveland man has been charged with 5 counts of murder. Markets were mixed at close yesterday. The Dow's going to open up at 97.72 next hour. The S&P will start at 10.45 and the NASDAQ at 20.57. We saw some close races all across the country yesterday. Analysts say they were a referendum on the president. But in your local race, did you or did you not vote because of President Obama?
Job creation, the farm crisis, health care, those are things that people are incredibly focused on. And it was not campaign rhetoric when I talked about that's what people spoke to me about.
That's Bill Owens, who was victorious in his congressional race in upstate New York. What about your local races? What got you to the polls? Let us know at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Okay, so the results in Virginia, New Jersey, and New York. Obviously, in New Jersey, if you haven't heard, Corzine was ousted.
John Corzine.
Was ousted.
The Republican governor from Goldman Sachs.
And Republican Chris Christie beat out the incumbent Democrat Corzine in the traditionally, as we said before, Democratic state of New Jersey. And then in Virginia, Republican, moderate Republican Bob McDonnell won there as well. But in the special congressional election in New York, the Democratic candidate Bill Owens won. And a lot of high profile Republicans got involved in that race.
Well, it's a long-term Republican district. It's presumed a safe Republican district, has been for years and years and years.
Right, but it became national news right when Didi Scozzafava dropped out of the race and said that the rhetoric in that race was becoming too divisive and too hateful, especially when Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh weighed in on that particular race. So we have kind of maybe perhaps mixed results, but what we're hearing them all morning long is that this midterm election was all about President Obama.
This election is a referendum on President Obama and his policies.
Basically voting against the Obama policies.
He just came into all this. You know, whatever happened was before his time.
You know, I just got on the CNN website, and now their headline is Elections Not a Referendum on Obama, even though that was from CNN.
Which
there at
is
the top.
It, CNN? Yeah. Let's go to Virginia first.
8 months ago, I applied for the job of governor of Virginia. Tonight, you have hired me. Thank you.
That's Bob McDonnell, the Republican, now governor-elect of the Commonwealth of Virginia. He actually got 59% of the vote, easily defeating his Democratic challenger, Kray Deeds. So let's talk to Robert McCartney again, columnist for The Washington Post. Good morning, Robert.
Hi, Celeste.
So this win in Virginia, what were people voting on? What were the issues in Virginia that people were voting about in this governor's race?
It was mainly a vote about jobs and the economy, taxes, transportation, and education on local issues. And I think those were most important, but there definitely was a national factor in the race. The Republican repeatedly tried to link his Democratic opponent to the policies of the National Democratic Party in Washington, especially big spending, deficit spending, cap-and-trade climate legislation. They weren't against, it was not a, you know, rebuke of Obama personally, because everybody likes Obama as an individual, but it was definitely, to some extent, a rebuke of Obama's policies, and certainly those of the National Democratic Party.
You know, Robert, what's puzzling to me is there in Virginia, that state is a recipient of a lot of stimulus money, particularly in the northern Virginia area. Why didn't that play positively for a Democrat?
Well, partly because they were very slow to spend the money. Huh. But that was really not a factor in this race. The Virginia, you know, is a purple state, classic purple state. It had gone Democratic in the last two governor's races, and it went Democratic for Obama in the presidential race last year for the first time. It's the first time since 1964 that Virginia had gone Democratic. But the Democrats could not get out to vote the surge voters who came out a year ago for Obama. The Democratic candidate Deeds couldn't connect very well with minorities. He didn't connect very well with young people. And I think an important thing to keep in mind is while national issues were relevant in the Virginia race, the Republicans ran a particularly strong candidate, and the Democrats ran a particularly weak one.
And you know, the other question there is this really about who was able to mobilize their vote? Because this is a midterm election, and clearly we didn't get the same voting populace to the polls that we did in the presidential election.
Absolutely right. This was a different electorate from a year ago. And I think one thing, the Republicans were very energized. They were very excited. They wanted to come out and try to end their losing streak. They wanted to register their dissatisfaction with Obama and the Democrats in Washington, much as the Democrats a year ago
were doing the opposite,
swarming out, right, you know, to reject the policies of George W. Bush, who'd been driving them nuts for 8 years.
Okay, that's Robert McCartney, columnist for The Washington Post, talking about what happened in Virginia. But let's go to New Jersey now with Bob Henley. He's a reporter for New York Public Radio, and this was the scene in New Jersey.
We are in a crisis. The times are extraordinarily difficult, but I stand here tonight full of hope for our future, full of expectations and dreams, not just for my children, but for all the children of New Jersey. And Kim and I are going to get to work to make that happen starting tomorrow.
That is the Republican governor-elect Chris Christie of New Jersey with his acceptance speech. And Bob Henley, how much of this vote was not about Republicans and Democrats, but was about John Corzine?
Much of it. We know from the exit polls that the three top issues were the economy and jobs, the property tax, which in New Jersey are the highest in the nation, and corruption in government. History never happens for one reason. There were a confluence of things going on here. We saw urban voters that had turned out in historic highs for Obama stay home, and we saw a surge in suburban, mostly white voters. You really turn out for Christie. And we also saw Middlesex County, which is kind of a blue-collar Reagan Democrat, if you will, kind of place the Democrats had been able to count on in the past, shifting right under their feet and moving into Christie's column.
And this is about Corzine really blowing it. I mean, he didn't have the confidence of New Jerseyites, right?
Well, I think also he had a kind of Garpian governorship. He had a near-fatal accident, which people forget about. A state trooper was driving and texting over a difficult love life. That cost him months. He also went from being a CEO of Goldman Sachs to the Senate for 5 years, which is a kind of solitary profession, even though you're with 100 individuals, was never really good at the kind of retail politics. I remember one very senior longtime legislative leader in Trenton saying to me, you know, he doesn't call people on Sunday after dinner in the legislature and ask them about the kids. He just didn't have that kind of almost pastoral connection that you need to get something moving forward, especially in difficult times.
Okay, well, that's what happened in New Jersey, but that's Bob Henley, reporter for New York Public Radio, but things happen in New York,
too. Corzine wouldn't call the people on Sunday about the kids. I mean, that is perfect image from Bob Henley. Well, speaking of images, it may be not a perfect image. It may be a disturbing image up in the 23rd District in New York. Brian Mann joins us, reporter for North Country Public Radio from Saranac Lake, New York. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning.
So all week long, we've been talking about the 23rd district race, which began as a Republican moderate, Assemblywoman Didi Scozzafava, who stepped forward, was going to be the Republican front runner. All of a sudden, the National Republican campaign against her as a Republican in name only, a so-called rhino, caused her to pull out of the race. And the Democrat has won. Bill Owens led with 49% of the vote. The Conservative Party candidate Douglas Hoffman had 46%. What are you going to do up there in the 23rd now to sort things out on this Wednesday morning?
Yeah, there's a lot of rubble here for sure. I mean, Doug Hoffman went from being a spoiler to being sort of a national crusade leader to being a spoiler again in the course of just a few days. I think the other thing that we've seen here is that Didi Scozzafava had the last revenge. She was kicked out of this race and kicked down the stairs by the Republican Party. She pivoted and endorsed the Democrat, campaigned hard for him in the final days, and in a very narrow election, that may have made the difference.
Is Bill Owens a one-termer in the 23rd, do you think? This is an unusual district for a Democrat, but a little bit like the Gillibrand story, she's now the senator in New York. That was also a district that was Republican for a long time and suddenly swirled in the wake of President Bush's difficulties.
Yeah, you know, what's happening up here is that the Democrats have been building a ground game steadily, bit by bit, piece by piece. And what we saw yesterday, in addition to all the drama, was a very mundane, down-to-earth, grounded labor union movement, progressive groups on the ground getting that vote to the polls. And so I don't think this is a flash in the pan. I think Republicans and maybe conservatives, too, if they can get back together, are going to have to look at this and say, we have to go back to the nuts and bolts of how do you win local elections. And the ideological stuff, you know, it's exciting. It gets you on Fox News. But does it win what amounts to a local race? This is a House race in northern New York, and that fell apart for the conservatives and the Republicans.
Well, let's talk about this ideology for a moment. Here's Republican Doug Hoffman in his concession speech last night.
I want to really thank everybody here and around the district and around America that stood up for our fight to take back America.
Now, Brian Mann, has the 23rd District said this take back America stuff is nonsense, or do they just say it's irrelevant to us? Please talk about fishing licenses in the Adirondacks.
Yeah, maybe not fishing licenses, but with unemployment at 11 or 12%, people wanted to hear about that kind of stuff, not the philosophy. So, yeah, it's nuts and bolts they want.
You know, theorize now, wild speculation, Brian Mann. Does Scozzafava become a kind of moderate Sarah Palin national figure traveling the country, raising money for Democrats?
I think what she does is she quits the Republican Party and becomes a Democratic Assemblywoman, so Republicans lose again.
That's great. We'll talk to you again about that, Brian Mann, reporter for North Country Public Radio in Saranac Lake, New York. Aftermath of the election. Interesting stuff.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Oh, yeah, we're taking it out, and we're taking a look at some stories we want you to be on top of this week, particularly climate change down in Washington. We talked about it yesterday with Todd Zwillick, Takeaway's Washington correspondent. This morning we're learning, Todd, that the business community, at least on Capitol Hill, is expressing some signals that it's more supportive of climate change in the House than we might have thought. What's going on?
Yeah, in the Senate, actually, the business community never gave too much support to what was being done in the House, but that didn't matter because eventually they'll marry the two proposals. But the latest news on this, you know, some big companies have been leaving the Chamber of Commerce over climate change. Big companies like PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric. How about Exxon, Apple Computer? There are others because the chamber has been sort of obstinate about getting on board and being constructive about climate change legislation.
So up till now, the Chamber of Commerce is supposedly against climate change, but why are these companies breaking? What's in it for them?
Well, they know they're going to get regulated. You know, there is a consensus forming in Washington, even though there are some skeptics, you know, that climate change is real and we have to do something about it. And when you're a big business, that means you know that eventually you're going to get regulated. So what that means for a lot of companies is get on board now, get on board early, be part of this, be part of the solution and be part of the discussion about how you get regulated instead of letting it get done to you. You know, it's sort of why a lot of insurance companies, at least at first, were on board with health reform. You know, they know it's going to happen.
Understood.
They might as well influence the process.
So has this pushed the Chamber of Commerce to step forward and take a maybe controversial position?
Well, it really did. They've sort of reversed their position on this. Now, Barbara Boxer, who is the liberal chairman of the Environment Committee, has been at odds with the Chamber of Commerce. She got some good news yesterday from the chamber when they put out a statement about the process that's going on in the Senate. And, John, you remember a couple of weeks ago, there was a bit of a funny hoax in Washington.
Oh, sure. Right. The yes men said that the Chamber of Commerce endorsed climate change, right?
You know, they say it. They held a press conference right. And issued a press release, and the whole thing was a big hullabaloo. It was sort of a big mess, especially for the chamber. Well, Boxer got a letter yesterday from the chamber and whipped it out in front of a whole bunch of reporters. Here was Boxer.
This one, we checked it out. It's real. It's not. Because I was anxious to read it into the record, and my staff said, don't read it into the record until we make sure it's the real thing. This is the real thing. And they're basically calling on us to act this Congress on a comprehensive climate change legislation.
All right, so Boxer didn't get hoaxed, but is she going to get this done by 2010? That's at least the prediction from the Obama administration, right?
Yeah, it's unclear if they'll get it done in 2010. You know, the ironic thing is the real action on this probably isn't with Boxer. If you really want to know where the action is on this, you got to look at John Kerry and Lindsey Graham. They wrote an editorial in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about their principles for climate change. They are sort of working alongside Boxer, but that's the part that the chamber is most excited about. So if you want to know where the action is on this, it's worth reading that article and knowing where the Senate's headed.
All right, Todd Zwillick, you go book Lindsey Graham and John Kerry for us for tomorrow's show. All right?
We're working them.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
Let's go to business now with Louise Story, finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Good morning, Louise.
Morning.
So for decades, the Disney company has brought China into our homes, and it looks like now they're taking us to China, right?
That's right. They've been trying to get into China with more than just their factories. They've been trying to get in there with a theme park for a couple decades. With
China.
A Disneyland. They're saying it's going to be about the size of Disney World in Orlando,
which is
huge.
It's gigantic.
It's gigantic. And this is a $3.5 billion investment, which is one of the largest ever foreign investments in China. So it's a big deal. Now, they had a loss on the situation. They were really pushing to get a Disney channel on the TV station as well. Because, you know, as Disney grows around the world, what they do is they get Disney Channel in.
And Disney Radio.
Yes.
Yes.
And
right.
That's how they get all the kids hooked on Ariel the Mermaid and on Beauty and the Beast and Mickey and Donald.
Right.
And China is really strict on their media content. So that's
To put it lightly.
Right.
Do the people of China love the mouse? I mean, are they excited about, do they even know who Daisy Duck is and all these characters?
Disney does have a ton of toy sales. In China.
Oh, in China.
They do. They do. And a lot of them
it's
are Mickey Mouse dolls.
There.
A lot of it is made there. So it's made right there. And so the thing they're going to have to tread lightly on, though, is the cultural differences. Because, you know, you probably remember when they went to France.
Yeah, it did not work out very well for
farmers showed up with pitchforks. I mean, it was really a conflict. And so they're looking at things like doing Chinese-themed rides. They haven't announced the rides. Apparently, they're thinking about It's a Small World, but I kind of think, you know, instead of Dumbo, the flying element, Dumbo, the flying elephant, they should do maybe like the flying dragon.
There you go.
Right?
Or
so
the panda.
The Mulan action. Okay, we'll see how that works out when Disney becomes Chinese.
It's a small
Louise
world.
Story is a finance reporter for our partner, the New York Times.
And eventually, even that French Disneyland became profitable. And
once they started
Tokyo
serving
well.
Alcohol.
Yeah.
That was
that's
the key.
Bury the lead there, Louise Story. So coming up, our last takeout from Takeaway Sports contributor Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. It's Game 6 of the World Series tonight, and it's a seniors pitching duel, it looks like.
You're right, but these are two pitchers, Pedro Martinez, who came up with the Dodgers. He pitched for the Red Sox, the Mets, and now the Phillies.
Now the Phillies.
And then Andy Pettitte, who came up with the Yankees, who also pitched for Houston. These are two guys that made their names and their amazing pitching stats in the steroid era. So they're very good pitchers.
Now explain something to me. It's everybody says that Pedro Martinez, of course, and you ticked off the teams that he's played for, is headed for the Hall of Fame, absolutely clearly. Andy Pettitte is the most successful pitcher in the postseason, and if he wins tonight, it's another huge game for him. How come Andy Pettitte isn't headed for the Hall of Fame?
That's a great question, but I think Andy Pettitte has an amazing legacy, and I think if he wins tonight, then he will be in the Hall of Fame.
But the question is, how many innings can these older guys on limited rest, I think they both have 3 days rest, right, or less? 3 days or less?
So, yeah, they're both running on short rest. I think the question is, can the managers, Charlie Manuel for the Phillies and Joe Girardi for the Yankees, do they have enough guys in their bullpen to be able to back them up? And what we're hearing is Charlie Manuel, he's prepared to put anybody in the game.
It's all hands on deck,
exactly.
Even in Game 6. And
precisely.
That's usually in Game 7 where it's all hands on deck. Now, 9 of the past 12 Game 6s, I'm looking here in the postseason, were decided by 1 or 2 runs.
Correct.
Do you think that's going to happen here?
I think it's going to be like an 8 to 9, 9 to 10 game. I think the bullpens are going to leak a little bit. This is the time in the series when the batters are getting used to the pitching, and they're going to start to just start hitting the ball, and everyone's on edge. These are two teams that come from behind to win. And I don't know if we spoke about it yet, but the Yankees are at home, which is a good sign. But
which means you have the designated hitter because you're using American League rules.
Precisely.
Right.
So since you have that, and then the other thing is the Phillies fans were crazy. They're waving the towels. They're going crazy, making tons of noise. It costs the high ticket range was about $20,000 to get a Phillies ticket. But in Yankee Stadium, the high range is about $50,000.
Wow.
Don't look for Yankee fans to be quite as crazy as Philly fans.
Because they're all bankrupt.
Oh,
exactly.
That's a good point.
Then. Right. And Mariano Rivera, the sort of Hall of Fame reliever, may be the difference in that Yankees game. We'll see if there's a Game 7. Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, thanks so much. Game 6 of the World Series tonight.
Yankees in 6.
There's
good
your
morning.
Takeouts.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, GM sales and Ford sales have gone up. Chrysler's have gone down. And in an 8-hour press conference today, Fiat Chrysler is going to tell us how they expect to change that. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But here's some of the news stories we're following at 32 minutes past the hour. One of the most interesting election results we've been talking about this morning was the one in upstate New York. A special congressional election for the 23rd district where the moderate Republican withdrew after being accused of being too liberal. In the end, it was a Democrat, Bill Owens, who won the race. Earlier, we spoke to former Connecticut Republican Congressman Chris Shays. He said at some point, conservatives have to decide whether a moderate conservative is better than a liberal Democrat. In New York City, however, Michael Bloomberg won a closer-than-expected contest for a third term as mayor. In other election news, the Republicans won 2 key governor races in Virginia and New Jersey.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has been meeting the Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in Egypt. She's trying to allay concerns about U.S. efforts to restart the Middle East peace talks. Back home, Game 6 of the World Series tonight in the Bronx. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
So we're going to hear from the CEO of Fiat Chrysler. Sergio Marchionne is going to make an announcement today, and it's going to take him 8 hours to do it. He's giving his 5-year plan for Chrysler, the struggling automaker. 8 hours, and we don't actually know what he's going to be saying. We're joined right now by Wes Lutz. He's the owner of Extreme Dodge in Jackson, Michigan. Good morning, Wes.
Morning.
Do you have any idea what Sergio Marchionne is going to be talking about for 8 hours today?
None at all, but I'm going to be watching.
Okay. We're also joined by Paul Eisenstein. He's the publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, an online magazine that covers the American auto industry. Good morning, Paul.
Hi, Celeste. Good to be with you.
Good to be with you, too. So any idea what Marchione's going to say for 8 hours?
Yeah, actually, we have a pretty good idea of a whole bunch of things. To sum it up in a nutshell, we'll be hearing a lot about product, the addition of a new brand, Alfa Romeo coming back as part of the new Chrysler Group, some products going away, some products being added, like an American version of the little tiny Fiat Cinquecento, you can say 500, it's easier. We'll be hearing about plans to possibly put Chrysler in the black by next year, and plans to get their quality up, because right now, as Consumer Reports and J.D. Power and just about everybody else tells us, their quality stinks.
Yeah, it's kind of in the toilet. Wes, you heard what Paul just said. You've been in the business, auto business, for 33 years. It must be a pretty good idea. I mean, you must be pretty happy about plans to get into the black, plans to up quality, right?
We're very anxiously awaiting the word. We haven't heard anything from Chrysler or from Fiat since they took over. So this is a big day for us.
You haven't heard anything since Fiat took over the company.
Well, I mean, they talk to us about ongoing business, but they've been very secretive about what they're going to do in the future. Mm-hmm. They have talked to, and I've talked to a lot of people at the headquarters. They said that they have been totally focused on product plan and everybody in the organization. That's all they've been working on.
And how have your sales been, Wes?
Well, they've been good, but I noticed that Chrysler was down last month, and we were down last month, but I don't have product. We can't catch up with our inventories. I have about 30 vehicles in stock. I normally stock about 150 to 180.
Wow. Well, right. You know, originally Fiat's interest, Paul Eisenstein, and Wes, you can weigh in on this as well, was to get the truck line and to be able to have a truck line, which is what they didn't have internationally. Then, of course, an enormous number of things happened. Do we expect them to hold the trucks and ditch most of the sedans, the Viper, the Hemi, the 300?
Well, we'll see a number of those go away, but we're also supposed to be hearing that some of the trucks will go away.
Really?
Particularly sport utility vehicles. Jeep has not done as well as it expected to, expanding its lineup. Put some pretty lousy products out there, oddly enough, in a segment that's been booming as people move from sport utility vehicles over to crossovers. They have not done very well. So we'll see some changes there. It's going to be a complete remix of what their product line is. And just to get back to something that Celeste talked about. I think one of the reasons that Fiat CEO Sergio Marchionne was so quiet was when he started walking around the plants and started going through the company's books and walking through its technical center, he found an absolute nightmare. I know people around town who've worked with him and some people inside that say they had no idea just how bad a situation Chrysler was in, how poorly run the plants were, how much of a mess they had at the factories, how much their capabilities were stripped out, how little engineering operations, for example, were left once the so-called merger of equals was split up with Daimler and Chrysler.
Daimler Chrysler. Paul, you're giving Wes indigestion here. But, you know, I think that probably Chrysler really took a fall also during the entire bailout process. Chrysler obviously took a lot of bailout money. There was a lot of talk about, will Chrysler go under? Will Chrysler even mm-hmm. survive? And when you compare that with how Ford came out of that process, Ford got good press because they didn't take any bailout money. And maybe that has made a difference between these two car companies as well. I mean, besides the fact that Chrysler, as you say, was kind of in a mess.
Yeah, no question about it. Chrysler took the worst heat of all, even as bad as GM got punched for how badly they were run. Chrysler just looked like the company that just had nothing going for it. And frankly, from what I understand, when the Italians came in and started looking, they sort of agreed that they'd have to start all over again. It's going to be a real serious process of turning things around. Marchionne is considered one of the superstars of the international
right.
auto industry, and if anybody can do it, I think everybody believes that he's the guy who can make this
he's,
work.
He's
though.
The Italian Alan Mulally. So Wes, at this point, having heard the reports from Ford, are you kind of wishing you were a Ford dealer?
Well, wait, I have to back up a little bit. I disagree with Paul somewhat here. I've seen the new Grand Cherokee that comes out next summer. I've seen the new 300, the new Charger, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and they're phenomenal products. I've seen the new Durango and the Styling Dome. I agree, from midsize down, we need a lot of help with product. But our truck line and our sport utilities that are coming this next summer are phenomenal. They're the yeah. most beautiful cars I've ever seen Chrysler produce.
I have to weigh in here. I have actually been inside the new 300, which is their large car.
It's a good-looking car, though.
It is. Well, I'm talking the new one, which virtually nobody has seen. Chrysler has long been beaten up for the fact that their interiors are cheap and cheerful. They use a lot of bad plastic. The exterior of the new 300 is as bold as the 300 was when it first came out 5 years ago. And the interior is almost Audi quality. And anybody who knows the auto industry knows that Audi designs the best interiors in the world right now until you get up to the super luxury market. Okay. Chrysler is getting up there. So there are some good things coming out of the company, but they've got a lot to fix.
Okay, quickly, Paul, we can't get out of this discussion of the big three without talking about the other three, which is the GM. Are we going to be seeing GM turn profitable?
Well, GM just had some good numbers with their October sales, and they're looking at some real turnaround numbers. There's a good possibility that they will go in the black next year, but there's still a lot of concerns about whether GM has really taken all the steps necessary to truly turn itself around.
Are we going to see any of this bailout money coming back to the government at some point?
The GAO just did a report that said we're not going to see all of the money come back. It's a question of how much.
Okay, Paul Eisenstein is a publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Wes Lutz, owner of Extreme Dodge, a dealership in Jackson, Michigan.
Depends on where the stock price goes of GM and Fiat Chrysler.
That's
where the value would come back to the government.
Right. Coming up, we're going to talk about how kids are affected negatively or positively by having gay parents. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Huckabee. We go to Atlanta now to talk with William Boone, political science professor at Clark Atlanta University and friend of The Takeaway. Dr. Boone, it's nice to hear from you again.
Good to be with you.
I wanted to get a snapshot of that mayoral race in Atlanta where Atlanta Councilwoman Mary Norwood could become the city's first white mayor. There's basically a runoff election now. She's going to face off against black state senator Kasim Reed, and the runoff will be held next month. What is the state of racial politics at the mayoral level in Atlanta? And this is a city where Mayor Jackson became the first big black mayor of a southern city, you know, a generation ago.
Yeah, that's correct. Quite frankly, the vote broke around the same way we thought it would, in terms that the north side of town, which is primarily white, went heavily for Ms. Norwood, and the other three black candidates sort of split the black vote. But Norwood cut very deeply into the black side of town, into black vote as well. So the candidates sort of split that with Norwood coming out fairly well.
As you've described, this is really a turning point for racial politics in Atlanta, in the sense that either blacks have to make a choice, either to vote in a block and basically maintain their strength in numbers, or allow perhaps more diversity among black candidates looking for a citywide office. That's a tough call.
Yeah, but I think that's going to happen, because remember now, the demographics in Atlanta are changing rapidly. And Norwood is able to cobble together a fairly diverse coalition, black, white, all across the city. And, of course, she's been on the campaign trail for about 80 years now and was able to put that together rather successfully. So we're going to have to see something very different happen in Atlanta.
Now, do you support in Atlanta African-American voters basically rallying behind a single candidate to preserve those strength in numbers, or do you think that this changing demographic is ultimately good for the city?
Well, I think actually how that should be addressed is the fact that the black citizens of Atlanta have always voted for the candidate they thought was in their best interest. I could refer you to the fact that black voters have always voted for white candidates. That has not been necessarily the case with white voters for black candidates.
Right. Hey, do you think this runoff is going to be as divisive as, say, the old Chicago races, where Harold Washington faced a white candidate in a Republican who would normally have no chance in the city of Chicago?
No, I cannot see either of those candidates doing that, or becoming to that particular extent. I mean, some of their surrogates may come out and speak in that way, but I doubt very seriously if either Reed or Norwood would do that. I think it's going to break along the lines of Reed accusing Norwood of being a Republican and that he's a true Democrat, although this is a nonpartisan race.
All right, finally, if Mary Norwood does become the city's first white mayor in a generation, is that a victory for racial politics in the city of Atlanta, or a defeat in some sense for an old-line constituency?
I think actually you have to consider that the fact that what you have here is a change probably in terms of the coalitions that will probably be forming in Atlanta, and it's probably more reflective of a changed demographic. But remember that some of the, I suppose, old-line folk are with Norwood.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I can talk city politics forever. I'm an old Chicago political reporter from way, way back. William Boone, political science professor at Clark Atlanta University. Thanks, as always, to be with us.
Thank you. Take care.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Celeste Headlee here at John Hockenberry. Coming up,
this is my dad, and this is my dad. How'd I get two dads? They inherited me.
I think we're father of the year.
He sounds pretty happy about it. We're going to talk about a new study that shows how kids really are affected by being raised by gay parents. More on that in just a moment. But first, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes past the hour. The GOP is celebrating two major victories in governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. But in New York's 23rd district, it was a Democrat who won a longtime GOP seat in a special congressional election.
A nail-biter in the mayor's race here in New York City. In the end, Mayor Michael Bloomberg narrowly won a third term. In other city votes, Atlanta and Houston's mayoral races are both headed for runoffs. And looking ahead in auto news, Fiat Chrysler will hold a marathon press conference later today, unveiling its new lineup of vehicles. That's after Chrysler said its October sales were down from last year. GM and Ford sales were up. And those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
In Maine, voters repealed a state law yesterday that would have allowed same-sex couples to get married. Gay marriage has now lost in all 31 states in which it's been put to a popular vote. That's a trend that they'd hoped to reverse in Maine, but it didn't turn out to be the same. And you have to wonder, John, if civil rights for women or blacks, if those had been put to popular vote, if those had been passed as well. It seems like the history of America is about courts and legislatures adding to the rights that we have.
Well, certainly there's an ideological component to the discussion of same-sex marriage that is absent from the civil rights discussions in the Supreme Court, that's for sure.
It is. And well, one of the things that they often bring up when they're talking about same-sex marriage is children.
We want strong families. We feel that mothers and fathers matter in the lives of children.
We think marriage does strengthen families and protect children, and that's why we should end discrimination.
This is about preserving traditional marriage and the benefits to children, the benefits for having moms and dads in their lives.
That's Brian Suchet. He's with the Stand for Marriage Maine group, and Shana Bellows from Protect Maine Equality. They spoke earlier this week on the show. They're talking about the benefits or drawbacks of gay partnerships on the children, what kind of effects they have on children. Well, before now, we really haven't known who's right, who's correct in this debate over how gay marriage affects kids. But Lisa Belkin, our friend Lisa Belkin, writes in this weekend's New York Times Magazine, there's now comprehensive new studies that show that children raised by gay parents don't seem to be harmed by the experience. In fact, Lisa, there's some benefit to it, correct?
You could look at it as a benefit, yes. I mean, if you wanted to take a broad sweep of the evidence, you could even argue that these children do better in many ways. They're more flexible. They're more tolerant. They're more likely to try different things in life that maybe their parents hadn't thought of.
More open-minded, perhaps.
More open-minded. Okay. And they certainly are no worse off. I mean, they have problems, but they don't have more problems than children raised by two opposite sex parents or by one parent or by any other kind of parent.
Okay, and these benefits accrue even if you account for age and socioeconomic status, those kinds of things?
Yeah, there are about 100 studies out there now because
right.
We now have a larger cohort that's old enough to actually study. It took time until these kids became old enough in large enough numbers.
Okay, so let's actually talk to one of these kids. Becca Lazarus joins us. She's a 15-year-old who's being raised by two dads in Windsor, Connecticut. Good morning, Becca.
Good morning.
For those of us who are looking at these studies and saying, wow, this is surprising, this is probably not surprising results for you, correct?
From my experience, no, not really.
Tell me about how the parenting dynamic works in your house. How does the parent-child relationship work between you and your two fathers?
It is very strong. Me and my parents are very, very close.
Well, is one more of a disciplinarian? Who goes over your report card with you? Who helps you with homework? How does it all work?
Both of them go over my report card, discipline me, and help me with my homework. And it's I don't want to say this, but it's a lot like I've been to my friend's household, and it's a lot like that. But just I don't have a mother. I have two fathers.
Do you celebrate Mother's Day and Father's Day?
I celebrate Mother's Day with my godparents, and I also I had a mother, and I go visit her at the cemetery where she is, and I go
she
visit
passed
my
away.
Grandmother. Yeah.
So, how about your relationship with other kids? Do you feel different from your peers at school?
Not at all. I live in a very diverse town. And I'm very proud to show who I am. I'm very proud to say who my parents are. And everybody, for the most part, accepts me.
Becca, so. My 11-year-old daughters have a question for you. And they're raised in a household of two heterosexual parents, okay?
Okay.
They would want to know, is having two dads as parents possibly just as annoying as having a mom and a dad, male, female?
It is.
Parents can be annoying no matter what. Okay, good. I just wanted to set that straight.
So, Lisa, Becca sounds extremely normal.
Becca sounds typical of what the data show. And, not to turn Becca into data. And nobody is absolutely. I mean, there is a range, and not a single statement can apply to everyone, obviously.
Right.
But the dynamic in a same-sex couple is not gender-based. So, you're starting out with a couple who doesn't default to gender, who doesn't automatically say, you do this, I do this, because society assumes. So there is more necessarily conversation. There's more variety. There's more equality. And this is something being modeled for kids that they don't get necessarily or as easily in a heterosexual couple.
So the models
are
kind of all
different.
Over the map.
The models are more equal on
average. So maybe Becca doesn't have any assumptions about what she can or cannot do based on her gender. Becca,
yes?
Have you ever missed having that female presence in the house?
Not at all. I'm
really? Not even talk about makeup or shaving your legs or as you get into teenage years, what clothes you want to wear to dances?
My parents are very good at helping with me with clothes for the dances, trust me. I've been there. And...
All right. Well, Becca, at the risk of being very insensitive here, okay, do your dads, approve of your wardrobe? And do you have to help them, change a tire or something like that? I mean, are the models really up in the air like this?
Well, they approve of my attire. Like, even my dad comes with me shopping and actually sometimes helps me pick out my clothes. And he knows what I like. We know what we like and all that. And every once in a while, yes, I do help them, and they help me, and it's just very...
Here's the question for me, Becca, because typically, and for most of my friends, when you get to dating, and you're 15 years old, you must be at that age, it's generally the father that threatens your date when he comes through the door with physical harm, and you have two of those dads. are your boyfriends, are your dates intimidated by two men standing there glaring at them as they come to pick you up?
She could have girlfriends,
She could?
Yes, I am dating. And my one boyfriend before the one I have now, was very intimidated by
poor guy.
Father. because to me, my parents, I'm an only child, so I'm their... and they're very protective of me in that way.
Yeah, I bet.
My boyfriend now has two overprotective mothers. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah.
Lisa, I mean, these studies of families, very often these studies come out about families and parenting and children. It's kind of ho-hum, but I imagine this one is going to get a lot of attention and politicized attention. Is it possible that this data can be questioned? You said that there's 100 studies, but can it be read in another way?
You can question any data, obviously. And yes, every study is not as perfect as every other one, but we're talking, I mean, this is the first time that someone has across the board looked at 100 of these studies, and it was done by a professor at Clark University. And the methodology is good. I mean, this is solid academic data. You can play it any way you want. Of course, there are wrinkles. It's harder to be the child of same-sex parents in that you seem to be teased more, at least about certain subjects. So there's more teasing about family. There's more teasing about sexuality. Is that a downside to a childhood? Well, arguably, yes. On the other hand, it's society teasing, it's not something inherent in the family.
Right. Lisa Belkin's a New York Times contributing writer, author of the Motherlode blog. You can check out her article on gender identity and parenting in this week's New York Times Magazine. Becca Lazarus is 15 years old, a high school sophomore in Windsor, Connecticut. Thanks to both of you for being with us today.
And all that candor gives you a lot to think about. If you want to re-listen to that conversation, go to our website, thetakeaway.org. You can get our podcast. There's a lot waiting for you at thetakeaway.org. We got a blog post from our D.C. correspondent, Todd Zwillick, too, about reaction in Congress to German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who addressed a joint session of Congress yesterday. Apparently, not a lot of the lawmakers paid attention. Find out more about Germans, Congress, and Blackberries all at thetakeaway.org.
Texting while driving, texting while legislating.
Texting while ignoring German leaders.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. All aboard the Burlington Northern with who's that famous billionaire?
Runaway train.
I just basically believe this country, you know, will prosper and you'll have more people moving more goods 10 and 20 and 30 years from now, and the rail should benefit.
I don't know what happened, but there's no engineer on this train. There's nobody on this train but us.
It's a bet on the country, basically.
You want to be a tough guy? You want to be a legend? Go back!
John Voight, Eric Roberts, Rebecca De Mornay.
And introducing Warren Buffett as the man who bought the railroad for $34 billion. He's betting on America, he says, and betting on future profits that look to him like...
runaway train. Let's have some fun.
Fun. Trains are fun on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from WNYC and PRI.
Trains are fun. All aboard. Good morning. It's Wednesday, November 4th. I'm John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee.
Woo-woo!
Yes, indeed.
Coming up, the Yankees fans are furiously counting unhatched chickens. Will the boys bring it home to the Big Apple tonight in the World Series? And was the vote in New York a vote against Sarah Palin, Rush Limbaugh, and far-right rhetoric? Maybe. Also, the people of Iran mark the anniversary of the hostage crisis with protests, and the Iranian government responds as they did 30 years ago with tear gas.
But first, Phil Longman at the New America Foundation. I feel like we're playing Monopoly this morning. Warren Buffett is buying a railroad, claiming it'll pay off like Boardwalk and Park Place. Is he right?
Yeah, he's got himself quite a steal out there. He's, for less than $34 billion, he's managed to buy up about a quarter of the rail infrastructure of the United States at a time when rails posed for real growth. So he's standing to be quite a rail baron.
Well, we'll see what it means to be a rail baron in the 21st century. Philip Longman, stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a moment. But first, everything else you need to know this morning.
Well, if you own all four railroads in Monopoly, you're probably going to win. In the headlines, lots of election results coming in. Here's some of the big winners. The GOP had big victories in two governor's races, Virginia and New Jersey. Purple and blue went red. Both governor's seats went to Republicans. But in New York, it was a Democrat who took a longtime GOP seat. That's in a special congressional election.
And staying in New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg got an unexpected run for his ample amount of money in the mayor's race. After late-night tallies, Bloomberg did win a third term. In other cities, Atlanta and Houston's mayoral races are both headed for runoffs in the Atlanta race. That city could put its first white mayor in office in more than 30 years. In auto news, GM and Ford say October sales were up from last year, but Chrysler says its sales were down. Chrysler is going to unveil a new auto line later today. In Afghanistan, five British soldiers have been shot dead by an Afghan policeman they were training. Last month, two American soldiers were killed in a similar attack. Training the Afghan army and police is a key part of NATO's strategy. In sports, the World Series heads back to New York tonight. The Yankees are up 3-2 over the Phillies in Game 6 of the World Series. Markets were mixed at close yesterday. The Dow opens this hour at 97.72. The S&P starts trading at 10.45, and the Nasdaq begins at 20.57. Futures trading on all three indices suggest suggests a positive to flat opening when Wall Street gets going in about a half hour from now. Close votes yesterday in races across the country. Analysts say the results are a referendum on President Obama. What do you think? In your local race, did you vote or not vote because of your view of President Obama, of national issues? What do you think of pundits who claim your vote might be tied to how well the president is doing? Tell us your story. All Politics is local at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
I often dream of trains when I'm alone.
Robin Hitchcock sharing with us there.
Right.
Dreaming of trains. We've been dreaming of trains since we learned yesterday that Warren Buffett made a big play for the railroads. You know, these days, being a billionaire has a certain allure. Warren Buffett's a billionaire. It gets you another
term. These days?
What gets you another term is mayor of New York City. Michael Bloomberg has a certain pizzazz. Warren Buffett is a powerful guy. You see him on the media all the time. Right. But does he match this sort of thing?
I've been playing hide and seek with the Pullman conductor ever since the train left New York.
How awkward for you.
Yes, isn't it? No place to sleep.
I have a large drawing room all to myself.
That doesn't seem quite fair, does it?
Drawing room E, car 3901.
Such a nice number.
Oh, yes. Once upon a time, the railroads were actually sexy. There's Cary Grant and Eva Marie Saint in Alfred Hitchcock's North by Northwest. They may be, again, these sexy trains, but not passenger rails. No, the boring freight trains.
Right.
That's right. The hot button in the 21st century.
You said boring.
Well, not to Warren Buffett, who announced yesterday that he will plunk down $34 billion for Burlington Northern Santa Fe Corporation, betting that moving freight is the future.
I just basically believe this country, you know, will prosper and you'll have more people moving more goods 10 and 20 and 30 years from now, and the rail should benefit. But it's a bet on the country, basically.
This is a huge story. I mean, the rail magnates are associated with the 1800s, but what does it mean to be a railroad baron in the 21st century? Still with us is Phil Longman, senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning.
And T.J. Stiles also joins us. He's the author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was the original railway baron in the United States. T.J. Stiles, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Phil Longman, what does it mean to make this $34 billion bet that Warren Buffett made yesterday? What does it mean to be a railroad baron in the 21st century?
Well, railroads went through a long decline in the 20th century. We almost lost them altogether in the 1970s. But since then, they've been making quite a comeback, especially on freight. Turns out that they're just a lot more economical and environmentally friendly than trucking, especially for long distances. So rail's been slowly gaining in profitability. It's also consolidated to the point where we really do have almost monopolistic conditions out there some places. And so Warren's, as usual, made a good call.
Now, you know, you said at the top of the hour that he got this for a bargain. I mean, the federal government has barely invested $10 billion in, you know, future light rail infrastructure and even in supporting Amtrak. So for a private sector investor to make a $34 billion bet, is this the kind of thing where that money goes into upgrading Burlington Northern Santa Fe, or is Warren Buffett just positioning himself to collect all the pennies from increased demand for freight?
Well, we'll see. It's a very capital-intensive business, and it needs investment to grow for things like new track and such. But just to get a sense of the scale, you know, $8 billion is going out the door for high-speed rail, and we're hardly going to get any trains, and right. Many of them will have to pay Burlington Northern Santa Fe to run them on their tracks.
This is an expensive industry. And T.J. Stiles, that was the story of Cornelius Vanderbilt. Building the railroads was not necessarily a profitable venture in the United States until the oil business came around, the energy business came around. How did that work?
Well, you're right. The first people who built railroads, some of them were built by state governments, were actually publicly owned. And a lot of those lines went bankrupt, and they got swallowed up. You know, Cornelius Vanderbilt, who was the greatest of the 19th century railroad tycoons, did not build new lines. He took over these small original lines and consolidated them and brought order to this new industry in America.
Now, in a sense, then, you're saying that Warren Buffett actually is following directly in the footsteps of Cornelius Vanderbilt, although he did say yesterday that he loves the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Corporation management.
Well, I think it's very different. In the 19th century, rail was everything. You know, the railway industry towered over America, and it was a young, growing industry with a lot of new companies that were failing. I mean, it was a lot like the dot-com boom and bust. You know, there are a lot of dot-com companies that were huge that disappeared, and that was the case in the early railway industry. Today, as you just heard, we've got railway companies that have consolidated, and that order that Cornelius Vanderbilt brought to the industry is already there. Warren Buffett is moving in when you know, things are kind of more stable than they once were.
So, Phil Longman, let's talk a little bit about this $34 billion investment. A huge fraction of Burlington Northern's freight is just in coal. One could say that all Warren Buffett is betting on is that there's going to be increased demand for coal. Is there more to it than that?
Burlington Northern does move a lot of coal, but also moves a lot of grain, and moves a lot of containers on their way from China to Walmart. So it's a much more diversified business than that.
I see. So who's to be happy this morning? People who work for the railroads, people who maintain track. If you're an Amtrak employee, is this a good thing?
Well, Burlington Northern generally has a good relationship with Amtrak, unlike the other roads. So, it's good for Amtrak. It's good for all of us out there who have come to pay more attention to trains, including freight trains, because they're so much more environmentally friendly than trucks. Warren Buffett may succeed in getting a lot of trucks off the road, and I think that'll make a lot of drivers happy.
Phil Longman, I'm wondering, how much is Warren Buffett betting also that the use of trains is going to diversify? And obviously, there's a difference between freight and passenger. But, you know, in the discussions yesterday, I was talking about how I moved cross-country by shipping my entire house on a train and how environmental it was and how cheap it was. And two people spoke up, surprisingly to me, and said, wait, I did the same thing. Is Warren Buffett thinking that as we move forward that other people are going to see the rails as a kind of a creative alternative?
Yeah, I hope he is, because we used to have all kinds of services in this country that provided by rail that we don't even think of as possible anymore. People 50 years ago would routinely have the Railroad Express Agency ship the refrigerator to their country cabin for the summer because the economics and physics of rail made that possible. Now we're paying $50 to bring our dirty laundry home on the airlines. So there's a lot of a lot of good things that can come out of making better use of rail, including on package freight.
That's an interesting takeaway. C.J. Stiles, how much of the infrastructure from the Cornelius Vanderbilt era has gone away in the decline of the railroads, and what would it take to restore it and to actually have railroad be as penetrated an infrastructure in American society as it once was?
Well, that's one of the problems with rail, is that, when it was first developing, it required government assistance for right-of-way and things like that. And governments are very friendly to rail because it brought development to towns and communities. Today, rail is seen as an annoyance to many communities because we have so many more modes of transportation. And that's one of the problems that rail still faces, even though I agree, I think the long-term future is bright. But, you know, people don't like it when you lay new track, when you try to improve the infrastructure. Right now in Chicago, there's tremendous congestion with freight trains trying to run through Chicago, which is still a major rail hub. That's what made Chicago great, and it still is a major rail hub. But they need to do a lot of fresh construction to clear up the bottlenecks there. And nobody wants a rail line running through their town. So there are some challenges there because our attitude toward rail as a country has really changed over the last, it's a 180-year-old technology.
Right.
And our relationship to it has completely changed. So I think as fuel prices rise and we worry about the environment, rail does have a bright future, but it does have these challenges. And a lot of that infrastructure has been ripped up or is aging. and will need replacing. So it is very capital intensive.
All right. T.J. Styles is the author of The First Tycoon, The Epic Life of Cornelius Vanderbilt. He was the original railway baron, and the remnants of his companies are in the CSX system, which actually operates in the East, among other places. Phil Longman, take us out with this. So what would it take to get the federal subsidy for truck lines and the interstate highway system to shift over to maybe restore some of this rail infrastructure politically?
Well, I think a lot of folks, including highway planners around the country, are realizing that it's a lot more efficient to put some public money into increasing the capacity of railroads than it is to add more lanes to interstate highways so more trucks can go on them.
Does Warren Buffett make that argument easier? Does Warren Buffett make that argument easier in just a few seconds?
Well, people wonder why we need to give capital to a billionaire's railroad.
So it may make it more difficult.
I wonder that myself.
It may complicate it. Indeed, Phil Longman, Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation, The Next Progressive Era, A Blueprint for a Broad Prosperity, is his book. Phil, thanks for joining us. We're talking about the implications for the American economy of Warren Buffett buying the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railroad.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Time for some takeouts, and we got more than just a takeout when we asked you about the value of getting a helping hand from the government, like getting food stamps. More Americans are on them now than ever before, 36 million people. We didn't hear from 36 million, but we heard from quite a few.
Hi, this is Lindsay from Detroit calling. I have actually been on food stamps for about a year. It was a really hard thing for me to go do. I had graduated a year ago and couldn't find a job. I'd been known to dumpster dive for like the first couple years coming up to getting food stamps.
I am very thankful for the food stamp program. I'm a single mom. I am going to college. I will graduate this next spring. And food stamps has allowed me to do that, so I'm not working a minimum wage job stuck on them forever. So, thank you, government.
It wasn't all thank yous, though. Dealing with the government always comes with some frustrations and moral dilemmas.
Hi, this is Mandy in South Carolina, and I've applied for food stamps numerous times and always been turned down because I've been told I was in the wrong demographic. What demographic do you have to be part of the 36 million getting free food?
My name is Lenny from New York City. All I know is that my parents came over here from Europe and that whole generation. They would be embarrassed to take any food stamps, any public assistance. They wouldn't even do it. They would work five jobs before they would take any food stamps or public assistance.
Well, perhaps this recession has changed some of that old school thinking about government handouts, or so says Ken from Johnston, South Carolina.
The stigma shouldn't be there because with most people, it's just a temporary help that they need to, you know, to get them by until they can find a job or get back on their feet. So, you know, if you lose your job and then you're on food stamps, you have a different look at to why you're using that system.
And LG adds in an email, Wall Street wasn't ashamed to take government bailouts after being allowed by the government to pillage our economy. Why should individuals, victims of the economic vagaries influenced by Wall Street, feel bad about getting government aid?
It's a good question. Yep. As always, keep those responses coming at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. So we're going to get our next takeout on business from Louise Story. She's the finance reporter for our partner, The New York Times. And good morning. And we're getting our very first indication of the financial state in October, right? We got retail sales.
Yep.
And what did they say?
So the early indications are that we're having a positive month.
Ta-na-na-na!
Right. I mean, that's a big deal because we haven't had a positive month. You know, we're comparing it to a year ago since August of 2008. Now, we have to hold off our excitement because it's compared to last October.
Hmm.
And you remember last October, we all thought the world was going to end.
Right.
So, you know, it's over that base. But over last October, you're seeing apparel sales up 3.4%, luxury goods up 6.5%, department store sales are down a little, but not down a lot. And so people are saying this is looking good. It's good for holiday sales.
Yeah, that's the question. Is this going to continue? Does this mean that the holidays might not be as bleak in terms of shopping as everyone's been predicting?
So people have been predicting doom and gloom.
Right.
But now the analysts on Wall Street are starting to say maybe we'll see holiday sales up 1%, 2%. It's a little like, you know, your kid has been getting Fs on his math test. Now he's getting a C and you're really happy.
Or a D.
Or a D and you're really happy.
I don't know how happy I would be. But you were talking about CIT's bankruptcy earlier this week and that having an impact on retail sales. If there is an uptick in demand, are retailers going to be constrained if CIT hits a bump here?
Again, I think that they've mostly locked in their financing because the inventory for the holidays all comes over in the summer. I think what we could see is that because we've all had doom and gloom expectations, they won't have as much inventory, so we might not see the kind of sales last year.
They didn't buy as much over
the
summer.
They didn't buy as much.
Here's the thing for me, Louise. Mm-hmm. Is this the first hint of light at the end of tunnel in terms of the recovery that Wall Street has been seeing? Is this the first hint that real people are seeing a recovery?
It has to continue because, you know, we've seen this up and down little wiggle in home prices getting better, getting worse, getting better, getting worse. It's kind of what happens at a bottom, right? And this has to continue month after month for us to really say things are getting better.
I think that's a no.
Is that a no?
I think that's a Louise story of the New York Times saying, Thanks so much, Louise.
Thank you.
All right, our last takeout for this segment comes from Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. We got a game six tonight. We've been talking about pitching, but let's talk about the bats. The Phillies face the New York Yankees here in New York. It's going to be American League rules. There's going to be designated hitters on the field. How do the Phillies bats stack up to the Yankees bats in this World Series Game 6?
There's a guy on the Phillies named Matt Stairs. He's the oldest guy on the field.
Yeah, he looks like a truck.
He does look like a truck. He looks like a truck driver is what he looks like. And Matt Stairs he'll probably play the DH position. It's not certain yet what their lineup is. But they have a bunch of guys in their lineup that hit fastballs. The good thing is that both Pedro and Andy Pettit.
Pedro Martinez for the Phillies and Andy Pettit for the Yankees.
They both pitch a lot of stuff. They're not fastball.
Sinkers, sliders, cutters.
So there's going to be, they've seen these pitches before. They know what they're throwing at them. So there's going to be some hits, but it's not going to be, I don't think that it's going to be a big powerball game. It's going to be doubles. It's going to be triples. It's going to be people getting on base and stealing base. So the key for the Phillies is to get a guy like Rollins, to get a guy like Ibanez, those guys, get those guys on base and have them steal in advance and then get some critical RBIs or some force out or some, flyouts where the guy, advances to the next base.
Both of these teams have demonstrated in this postseason that they are very skilled at advancing runners in the infield. So the infield play might be the key tonight.
And last game, they had each team had an error. So the key actually is errorless baseball because most of the errors will come from those little short bounces on the infield. And because tonight is dry, you won't have a lot of that. The ball won't be slick. So look for an errorless game.
Exactly. Weather is not a factor. So the milestones people will be looking for, can Utley break Reggie Jackson's home run record, right?
Correct.
For a World Series.
Correct.
And he's a Phillies player.
And can Ryan Howard break his streak of strikeouts?
And he's got 12 right now, one more, and he will hold the record for strikeouts in the World
Series.
Correct,
exactly.
What about Pedro Martinez? This is all about personal revenge for him. He has to win this game.
He has to, but he's not going to. I don't want to predict that he's going. I mean, I think if the Phillies win, it's not going to be because of what Pedro did in his time. It's going to be because of what the bullpen did and how they backed him up.
You know, I was reading that the first year for the old Yankee Stadium, they won a World Series.
Correct.
Back in the 20s. If they do it this time,
that's a new Yankee aura that will settle into the Bronx.
And if there's a new World Series champion in the new stadium, that will be more aura that you're going to have to deal with.
More aura
here,
like
in New York.
More
move to New York.
Yankee,
you
got
to deal with Yankee aura here. That's a part of the job.
I wish them well.
Thanks, Ibrahim. Ibrahim, we should disclose to our listeners, is a Yankee fan.
He is a Yankee
He's
fan,
a Yankee
and
fan,
I surprisingly, I'm not.
But he actually wants the Phillies to win tonight. He wants the Phillies to win tonight to go because he just likes more games.
He wants the drama.
He likes more games. That's right. He goes for the best story. That's why he's our contributor, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports Contributor. Coming up, using leftovers to advance your cuisine.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, gleaning messages from yesterday's elections around the country. We're going to talk with the last Republican from New England. Chris Shea is former Republican for Connecticut. Right now, let's check in with some top news stories at 32 minutes after the hour. Quick recap of those election results. Republicans won two key governor's races in Virginia and New Jersey. In New York City, Michael Bloomberg won a close contest for a third term as mayor. In other mayoral races, Atlanta and Houston are both headed for runoff elections. And in Maine, voters repealed a state law that would have allowed same-sex couples to marry. Overseas, Israel says it seized a cargo ship carrying weapons in the Mediterranean. Media reports in Israel say the arms included anti-tank missiles and could have been destined for Hezbollah forces in Lebanon.
In Afghanistan, there are concerns about discipline within Afghan forces and possible infiltration by insurgents. That's after an Afghan policeman opened fire on British soldiers. Five troops died in the incident in the volatile southern province of Helmand. Back at home, the Yankees are going to take on the Phillies at home tonight for Game 6 of the World Series. That's a look at some of the stories we're watching this morning.
So on this morning after Election Day, an off-year election, we decided we would talk with former Republican Congressman Chris Shays, who earned a reputation as a moderate while serving in Congress from 1987 until his defeat in the November 2008 election a year ago. Actually, that was today, right, Chris Shays? Year ago today. Well, you've been busy.
I try to forget.
You've been busy, though. You were elected to the board of directors for the CIT Group, which is a New Jersey-based commercial finance company. You're co-chair of the Commission on Wartime Contracting in Iraq and Afghanistan. And, you know, you've had plenty to do in the last year. But the reason why I wanted to talk to you, Chris Shays, is, you know, there are some interesting and, I would have to say, puzzling lessons for the GOP in the victory in Virginia and in New Jersey, and this curious defeat up in the 23rd district, a supposedly safe Republican district in northern New York. What do you make of it all?
Well, it's very clear. A party that has to adhere so closely to ideology is a party that will become smaller and smaller and smaller. I was the last Republican in New England. There are now 21 Democrats, no Republicans. There are 29 congressional seats. There are 29 congressional seats in New York, and there are only two members of the Republican Party. Huh. So out of 50 seats, we have two. You're not a national party. You're not going to be viable. And so, you know, there's going to be a point where conservatives are going to have to decide that a moderate conservative is better than a liberal Democrat.
Well, how much of this is the pendulum swinging versus some strategic error on the part of the GOP leadership?
Well, first off, one of my takeaways, you do a lot better when you don't hold the White House.
Interesting. Interesting.
No. I mean, you know, I knew when George Bush won, George W. Bush won, you know, nine years ago, I knew that I would be threatened because the moderate is the center of the attack of either the Republican or Democrats. Republicans go after the moderate blue dogs. The Democrats go after the moderate Republicans.
Huh. So that your vulnerability was clear even 9 years ago.
But you know what's the irony? Most Americans are center-right, moderate right or moderate left. That's where most Americans are, and both parties run to the extremes.
Well, let's talk about the curious case of Dee Dee Scozzafava. All right, she's an assemblywoman in northern New York in that 23rd district, moderate Republican who was put forward by the GOP there in a special congressional election until some people like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and some maybe more ideological members of your party got wind of it, accused her of being a Republican in name only, a so-called rhino.
You know, and it's the most irritating thing to have people who've never run for public office lecture people on how they should run for public office. One of the key parts of a party is to enable a party to represent a district. I mean, enable a candidate, their candidate, to represent a district. If you have to be such an extreme and can't represent the very people you were elected by, you're ultimately going to get defeated.
Well, even more than that, though, even more than just irritating, the irritating quality of being lectured by people on the radio and, you know.
But who've never run for public office.
But it went beyond that because Dee Dee Scozzafava, after really a long career of public service, essentially took herself out of that entire career. She campaigned for a Democrat. I mean, how do you respond to that disillusionment?
You know what?
Well, let me say, her final action justified, in some cases, the criticism that conservatives had. I understood that given that she was doing so bad in the polls, she might want to drop out. But my sense was that she should have either been quiet or supported the Republican candidate. And she did Newt Gingrich no favor because she almost gave the indication that she really was more Democrat than Republican.
Well, putting that aside for a second, and that's a very interesting point. I haven't heard that elsewhere. But can you understand the level of disillusionment where you go from an exciting congressional race where you think you have a chance to win to deciding to just basically walk away from the entire public sector? Is that what this ideological debate does to people?
Politics is tough. You had a candidate, a great friend of mine, a congressman in Maryland. He lost a primary, and he was a good member, and ultimately he supported the Democratic candidate. But some of that is out of pique. It's like, you know, you hurt me, and I'm going to hurt you. Now, the other part of it is, it's also a lesson. You could look at it another way and say, listen, if you want to make this an issue that it's got to be a pure conservative, not a Republican, then neither's going to win, and I'll make sure it happens. If conservatives say, I'm not going to support a moderate, that there's a real temptation for a moderate to say, I won't support a conservative. But you don't become a national party with that kind of approach.
Chris Shays, in terms of polarizing the electorate, coming up with ideology and the kind of rhetoric that really fires people up, that was seen as a way to get your voters out to the polls 10, 15 years ago. That's how you motivated your electorate. And to a certain extent, many of the people in upstate New York seem to have been saying, we don't like this anymore. That motivates us in the exact opposite direction.
Or it motivated Democrats.
Exactly.
But, well, you know, in the previous presidential election, not this last one, but the one before, 42% of the American people were purple. They weren't red and they weren't blue. And they had no party. It was basically 28% Democrat, Republican each. And then you had this 42%, 29-29, then you had this Republican, this group that isn't being represented by anyone. And that's why you have, I think, a lot of unhappiness in our country. They don't see anyone who represents them anymore.
Well, Chris Shays, you speak for them this morning on this program. Chris Shays is a moderate Republican from the state of Connecticut and a former representative who served from 1987 to 2009, voted out in 2008. Representative Shays, thanks so much for joining us. Coming up, we ask the question, what's for dinner tonight? And what's the sell-by date?
Maybe the answer is what was for dinner last night.
Or the night before.
Exactly.
And the night before. Some creative ideas on how you can remake your leftovers, actually turn them into cuisine, including old rice and old bread, later on in the hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckabee.
And I'm Celeste Headley. 30 years ago, Iranian students seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran.
Outside the gates, armed Revolutionary Guards in their combat fatigues, unloading and reloading their M16 American-made rifles, and meanwhile, piles and piles of sandbags being made ready just in case.
That was a very long siege. 52 hostages held for 444 days. We have one of them on the line with us now, Barry Rosen. He was then the press attaché in Tehran, the last press attaché to Tehran for the U.S. Embassy. Now the director of public affairs of the Borough of Manhattan Community College of the City University of New York. Good morning, Barry.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit first about your experience during the hostage crisis over those 444 days.
Well, you know, it's hard to encapsulate it in one real summary, but I can just say that it was one of these situations where one was totally surprised that the Iranians would actually do something like that. And then day in and day out, we were subjected to interrogations. We were tied up, bound hand and foot, tossed around like piece of meat, jailed in Evin prison, one of the notorious prisons of the Shah, and now one of the notorious prisons of the Islamic Republic of Iran, where many, many dissidents are now in jail. Spent 6 months there, shifted around after the attempted rescue into what I recall dark holes all over Iran. I landed in Isfahan and other places. No light,
But, you know, Barry, all that sounds pretty bad, and you would expect that that experience to have prejudiced you against the country of Iran.
Well, it does prejudice me against the Islamic Republic of Iran and the leadership, even what is considered the more reformed elite of the Islamic Republic. But it doesn't. I have to separate my feelings about Iran and my feelings about this regime. Iran is a place where I was a young man. I was a Peace Corps volunteer there. It was the first place I ever traveled to in my entire life. I speak the language. I care about the culture and the civilization, and I feel for Iranians and the loss of civil liberties, and also that Iran could have been one of the great democracies of the Middle East if it weren't for very bad U.S. policy during the Eisenhower administration and until President Carter.
So what are the chances it will become? I mean, what are the chances that these protests that we're seeing, that the outcry against the Ahmadinejad regime, will it end up in real political change in Iran in the years to come?
I don't think there will be real political change. I think what is happening right now in Iran is a situation where it's becoming a more militarized state. I think that the current regime is not one like a young revolution where people had much to say about almost anything, a very, very wild society in one way that almost anyone can open up a newspaper one day and then the regime would close it down. Now we have a militarized state where the theologians themselves are in arguments, but the real power is in the power of the revolutionary guards. They're the ones who are supporting Ayatollah Khamenei and Ahmadinejad now.
Barry Rosen is a former hostage during the crisis in Tehran 30 years ago and now director of public affairs at the Borough of Manhattan Community College of the City of New York.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. We want to teach you to embrace your leftovers. That discussion coming up. Embrace them, not to do something other than throw them in the garbage. A discussion of leftover cuisine in just a moment. But right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Republicans are celebrating victories in two big governor's races in Virginia and traditionally Democratic New Jersey. But it wasn't all a GOP victory. In a special congressional election in New York, a Democrat took a longtime GOP seat in a race that split conservative and moderate Republicans. And staying in New York, in the city of New York, Mayor Michael Bloomberg narrowly clinched a third term after late-night rallies. But in Atlanta and Houston, voters will have to come back for a runoff to pick their mayors.
In other news, in Ohio, police have been talking about their search for more bodies at the home of a convicted rapist. Cleveland Police Chief Michael McGrath says the body count is now at 10.
We discovered four more bodies in the backyard, and the dig continues. The dig continues. We're not finished.
That Cleveland man has been charged with 5 counts of murder so far. Chrysler unveils a new generation of vehicles later today. That's after it said October sales were down from last year, but Ford and GM say their October sales were up. Looking ahead, the World Series is back in New York tonight. The Yankees are up 3-2 over the Phillies in the series. And in Iran, that's the sound of protests in Iran's capital, Tehran, as police clashed with opposition supporters. Those protests are timed to coincide with an official rally to mark the 30th anniversary of the seizure of the American embassy during the Islamic Revolution. We talked earlier this morning with the BBC's Tehran correspondent, John Line, and I asked him, what's happening in Tehran today?
Well, this is an annual rally. I went to the same event last year, actually, when I was still in Tehran. On that occasion, just a few thousand, not a very big event, you know, not much enthusiasm, really, for these commemorations. But now the opposition, protesting still about the election they say was stolen, the re-election of President Ahmadinejad, is latching on to all these government rallies and turning out to them and trying to turn them into opposition protests. So large numbers, not quite clear how many, but I think certainly several thousand, possibly even tens of thousands of opposition supporters have tried to gather in the streets, but there's been a tough response. The police have been out with tear gas, possibly even rubber bullets, some people claiming live fire. and have been trying to disperse them. So instead, the opposition have really been gathering smaller groups, still managing to make an appearance despite that intimidation.
Are these protesters remaining vigilant? I mean, or are they becoming discouraged in the face of this strong reaction from the government?
Well, they've come out. I think they have managed to coalesce into one big demonstration, but there have been a lot of smaller demonstrations. And I think the point is they're continuing to harass the government and show the government that it's not all over. They're still disputing the result of the election.
That was John Lyon, BBC Tehran correspondent. We talked to him earlier this morning about the 30th anniversary of the seizure of the American embassy in Tehran.
Well, as everyone knows by this time, I love Wednesdays because
yes.
I love to talk about food, which is what we do every Wednesday. I also love to cook. You love to cook, too,
right? I love to cook.
I mean, as joyful as it is to make a fantastic meal at home, it may be even more joyful to do it with things that are around the house, leftovers, doing things that sort of bespeak your intelligence in the kitchen, your strategic use of food and buying of groceries, that sort of thing.
Right, but it's dangerous, too. I had a sister who liked to throw together ingredients that were in the kitchen, and it didn't turn out well.
Well, food poisoning is never recommended when you're cooking for guests, depending on what's in your larder there. But 14% of the food Americans purchase gets thrown away.
That just hurts my heart.
And, you know, San Francisco has just implemented a new law, a composting law, where all residents and commercial buildings must compost their food waste. So people have to get smart about food and about leftovers. And here to help us do that is Cecilia Hagen Lee, food writer and author of the book Quick and Easy Korean Cooking, and working on the upcoming book Quick and Easy Mexican Cooking. She joins us from Los Angeles. Good morning, Cecilia.
Good morning.
So, you know, you have to have a certain kind of intelligence to deal with leftovers and not end up either poisoning yourself or making stuff that, quite frankly, doesn't taste very good. How do you do that?
In my culture where I grew up, we hardly had any waste, so it's sort of like if you had old rice, you always made something with it. I don't think it has to do with intelligence.
Well, what can you do with old rice, and how do you keep old rice from actually making sure that everyone knows that it's old rice?
Well, you know, make sure that you refrigerate it first. And then we'd always make things like fried rice, or we'd put it in, you know, soup and things like that.
You know, Cecilia, it occurs to me that, you know, so often food, as far as a grocery store is concerned, goes bad very, very quickly. And as soon as mm-hmm. it doesn't look perfect anymore, they get rid of it or they put it on manager's special in the clearance rack and it goes away. But it seems to me like if you were actually using some of these more creative recipes, you could go to the store and save a lot of money.
Yeah, definitely. My parents have a grocery store. And so, I mean, I'm used to eating old food or cutting off half of a bad apple and eating it. So I just grew up that way.
All right. Well, then you're an expert. Oh, so Cecilia Hagen Lee.
Expert on leftovers, yes.
What do you throw away? What do you just not bother with?
Well, you know, if there's any mold, you want to throw that away.
Okay, right. Obviously mold.
Yeah, definitely. You don't want anything moldy.
Unless it's blue
or rotting
cheese
or anything.
But is there some
Unless
ingredient?
It's blue cheese. It's something that's supposed to be moldy. Right. Yeah, like cheese.
Is
definitely.
There something that's not worth trying to make a cuisine over?
Like old lettuce.
Okay,
old
lettuce.
Old lettuce?
Yep. Forget it.
You
that's
know,
a
it's
watch
like,
out.
You know, you just have to go, okay, that goes in a compost bin.
That goes in a compost.
Well, that's the question is, are there certain cultural cuisines where some of the dishes in that culture were actually designed to eliminate food waste?
Right, absolutely. I think in most cultures there are because, you know, in Asian culture, fried rice is what you do with leftovers. So I never like ordered in a restaurant because it's like, oh, that's what we do with leftovers. I'm not going to order at a restaurant, you know.
It's great.
The same thing. And the same in Mexican culture, like with tortillas. You know, you take leftover tortillas and you make like chilaquiles, or you do something else with the tortillas. Well, first you make tortillas and you make tortilla chips.
Right.
Then when you take the leftover tortilla chips, and you can make chilaquiles with it. So there's so many stages of not throwing away anything.
Now, you describe chilaquiles as the ultimate in Mexican comfort food. Explain, first of all, what they are and how you would cook them and what other ingredients you would use.
Chilaquiles are a dish made with leftover tortillas that have been fried and old salsa and any kind of meat you have left over. So if you have taco filling left over or, you know, or shredded chicken, you put that in there. You put the salsa on top, whatever salsa you have around. You put cheese on it, and then you bake it all. Or you can cook it up in a pan, depending on how you want to do it.
And all these things keep while you're deciding when to make the chilaquiles or whether you're doing just the leftover rice. I mean, the preservation mm-hmm. of stale food actually is less of a problem than the original fresh food, right?
Definitely, because you're just going to cook it up. It's actually better to have it. Some of it is better to have stale. It actually tastes better if you cook it that way.
Well, we've got a couple of things here. Our producer, Jen Poyant, has cooked, at your suggestion, some things. And the first thing that I'm going to eat here, and I'm going to eat it, and I'll have you explain what it's all about, is this chocolate bread pudding, all right?
Yes.
Made with what kind of bread?
Leftover stale bread, French bread.
So you can take stale bread and make... Oh, that's delicious.
Mm-hmm.
That is really delicious.
That is really good.
So I'm always throwing away stale bread. Explain to me the kinds of things, including this recipe, that help me to keep from just throwing it away.
You can make chocolate or any kind of bread pudding. And actually, bread pudding works better with stale bread than regular bread, because then you don't get it soggy. You can make croutons. You can make bruschetta.
Now, how do you make stale bread into a bruschetta without having it just be a hard slab?
Well, you sort of bake it and then put the bruschetta on top, and then the liquid sort of goes into it and it makes it softer.
And in fact, you know, probably that's what the Italian cooks used bruschetta for. That's what it was all about. It was probably about recycling. All right, so now the other dish we have here, which is actually even more intriguing than the bread pudding was decadent, is this kimchi fried rice.
And it's what you do when you have sour kimchi that's, you know, gone a little bit past its prime, and you have leftover rice, which in the fridge, and then you cook it up in a pan with whatever vegetables you have.
Now, you cook it up with oil, with butter? Do you just heat it slowly? Do you worry about burning?
I use a combination of sesame oil and a little bit of butter for flavor, and sometimes, you know, a little extra oil depending on how much, if your rice is sticking or not to the pan.
Cecilia, I just want to ask one little question. Why does sesame oil work on everything?
I don't know, but it does. It just, you could just put it on everything. It probably works great with dessert too.
Thanks for the great advice, Cecilia Haejin Lee, food writer and author of the book Quick and Easy Korean Cooking, giving us some strategies on using leftovers more effectively and reducing our food waste, and also making sure that the stuff gets into the compost, not the trash. Cecilia, thanks so much.
Sure.
And you can check out Cecilia's recipes for that chocolate bread pudding, which was delicious, and the kimchi fried rice, and also chilaquiles that she talked about. That's on our website, thetakeaway.org. While you're there, we've got a blog post from our D.C. correspondent, Todd Zwillich. He was there to hear German Chancellor Angela Merkel address a joint session of Congress yesterday and talked about the legislators who weren't paying attention to the German chancellor. You can check that out.
Not paying attention? To the German?
Never give John Hockenberry a chance to do an accent.
No. Don't do that. We're also talking with you about yesterday's close races around the country. The election had some very interesting results. Analysts say it was all a referendum on President Obama, but what did it mean in your race? Did you vote for some local issue, or was it about Obama? You can tell us at 8778-MYTAKE or send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Celeste Headlee. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
I'm Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, our team has been reporting high-quality news about science, technology, and medicine. News you won't get anywhere else. And now that political news is 24/7, our audience is turning to us to know about the really important stuff in their lives. Cancer, climate change, genetic engineering, childhood diseases. Our sponsors know the value of science and health news. For more sponsorship information, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.